Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we have another great show dealing with the, we'll call it, spiritual issues and consciousness, particularly this evening. Science, of course, metaphysics. So hopefully this will be a show that I think will bring together some points that will answer questions for people. And I hope tonight's show is really going to be what I would consider to be an eye-opener. So let's start off with what it's about, the development of consciousness. Now, I've had shows about consciousness before, but tonight we've got 2 hours, and if I go over, I'll just make more time next week. But the important part of tonight's show is really to debunk some issues about what I call the mysteries of science in not being able to define or explain consciousness. And unfortunately, attempting to use the real science of evolution and brain or neurological development to define or explain consciousness. And unfortunately, those don't work. And I'm going to go into why they don't tonight in a little more detail than normal. And I'm going to explain how come God chose what I'm going to hopefully explain as its method of developing consciousness, rather than some mechanical process that is inclusive of some of the scientific explanations. Now, to be completely fair, there is no scientist that I am aware of who defines their work as explaining what consciousness is. So I don't want to be building straw man arguments here and going after people who really aren't claiming that they understand consciousness. But unfortunately, after they explain their brain theories and neural networks and the explanation of evolutionary development of the brain and on and on and on, they usually define all of that is mind and consciousness in a kind of, we'll say, leap of fantasy without actually bridging it to any of the work that they actually have done. That's not to say that there hasn't been great strides made in understanding how awareness and senses work, to some degree at least, not their connection with consciousness, though, and how knowledge can even be derived and or stored in a capacity within the brain. This is completely consistent, for those of you who have read like my textbook, et cetera, with what I've been writing for many, now it's decades, about this, but it doesn't explain it. So there really aren't adequate explanations of what is meant by mind or consciousness, other than the words are used. Which, like I said, this is like a leap in fantasy to use words that aren't adequately defined by one's research or science and imply, even if they don't clearly define, that this really means the same thing, and it doesn't. So let me tell you what consciousness is so that we have a clear understanding. Consciousness is the ability to use knowledge that is derived from fairly, it doesn't have to be real, but fairly accurate information, which comes from senses, in anything that we call life, to use the knowledge to connect to new elements of sense, new elements of information, and to see the connections between those elements and understand them. So we could say consciousness and understanding are virtually the same thing, but understanding and knowledge are not. Knowledge is the ability just to build together a system of information into a, we'll call it, a logical system of defining something that someone perceives. But it doesn't say that that person understands how that something connects to anything else, or even in standing in itself, what does it really mean? So there's a huge difference between consciousness and knowledge, and a huge difference between understanding, which is part of and almost synonymous with consciousness, and information that is built into knowledge. Because someone has a lot of knowledge and or information, the information is what comes through their senses. Even if the information is accurate, doesn't mean they understand anything. It just means they could literally possibly parrot or speak back some of the elements of the information that they hear or see, feel, touch, you know, smell, taste, and other ways of sensing. So consciousness is really a much different thing. And what is consciousness anyway? I mean, I'm telling you it's understanding, but it still doesn't define anything in terms of what I want to explain. So let me put it like this. Consciousness is the direction or connection of various parts of creative thinking or creative thought. It's the part that connects one thought to another. It's the part that makes thoughts into thoughts, because without there being connections from one thought and another, by my definition, you don't have completed thought. You have the beginning of what thought could be, but without connection to any other thought, I don't believe that thought really is even fully thought itself. And how is it that the Creator, God, chose that consciousness be a part of its existence or its own way of expressing itself, since consciousness seems to be one of, if not the, emphasis of the development of life itself? We'll get into that in tonight's show, but I'm bringing it up as a supposition right now. And that is that if we look at God, God is self-created. How is God self-created? Because within a field of potential thought, it not only chose to think about something, which means that it had the freedom to do so and created some kind of thought, but it connected that thought to some other elements of other thoughts that it had. And some of those beginning thoughts were, I exist. I am. Then the next thing you would presume that this great being, God, did, said, I exist, I am, and what does that mean? What does that matter to? How does that change what is around, which is anything and everything? Well, how does that change anything and everything that I can choose to think about? And how does that change me? That is called understanding, and that's part of the consciousness development. God saw that that's what it did for itself, on its own, not needing anyone or anything to create that part of itself. It's self-created. Well, if that's self-created for God, and God wants life to have the same or similar opportunities that it had, maybe on a lesser scale, at least in the beginning, then it has to develop this, give life the opportunity to develop the same thing that it got, which is understanding of itself and everything else around it and the relationship between the two. And that is what consciousness is. So like God says to itself, let there be life, which we can, and if it so chooses, eventually think of, as I do, which we call spiritual thought, and co-create with its creator, with me, eventually, when it's capable of doing so. And so that's the beginning of the process of creation of life. And again, it's based upon consciousness, not information or knowledge, but consciousness, because consciousness is something way beyond information or knowledge. It doesn't mean that you can throw away information and knowledge, because they are another part of God. They have to do with the third part of God's mind, which has to do with intelligence and the ability to communicate intelligence to other parts of life, which you have to have senses for, and bodies, and containers for information, which we call brains, and all kinds of stuff. Those are good things, and they're still part of God's own mind. But the first two parts of God's mind, which have to do with the choice or creativity, lots of words, freedom, all those things that are the first parts of God's mind have to be joined to the second part, which is consciousness, to have real thought. The first part without the second part is just meaningless, idle possibles, but no direction to the possibles, which doesn't limit them in some way or limit the field of possibilities that could be made into something, and therefore there's no real thought. So giving a direction to one's creations in one's thinking allows completion of thought. And it also puts a limitation on the nature of thought itself, because the thought is now moving in a specific direction and has a propensity for creating more thought of similar kind. Once you do that, that's called limiting a field. I didn't really get too involved with the science part of it, because that's a bore getting into science and how to understand fields and, you know, the quantum field theory. It gets real complicated. It's really not necessary for us, because this is not a show into mathematics. It's a show dealing with concepts. Okay. So I hope that has helped. Now, everything I said may be a little over the top for some people to follow, particularly if you haven't heard some of my other shows or read some of the stuff I've written. I apologize, because this is not easy. This is like the big picture, we'll say. Matter of fact, the chapter this comes from in my textbook is called The Big Picture. So the problem is that just to understand what consciousness is requires a significant level of consciousness. And that significance may be challenging some people. That's not to say all of you out there don't have a lot of consciousness. I think you do. But this is a challenging level that we're talking about tonight. Okay, let's get to some examples, because I like this show and that we have time to do that tonight. And I'm going to try to build a system for you with examples instead of all these concepts, which probably you're still going, huh? What did he say? I'm going to have to listen to that 5 times before I get it. Okay, that's all right. You can go back and listen to it. You know you can do that. But let's move on to some examples that might make a lot more sense. And I'm going to do it from the perspective of God, so that we can kind of get an understanding of how come this system even exists this way. Why is it just randomly part of evolution or something, which makes no sense. But we'll get there. Okay. So a part of God, a subpart really, it's significantly smaller in some respects, is the beings that operate through our planet. And some of these beings, in their own right, are like godlike in their abilities, etc. We can call them all God, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't really matter if you believe any of that or doesn't, you know, well, I'm a sub-god or some this. It doesn't matter. As far as our perspective, anything that could create an entire planet of life is something pretty far out there, right? It's not us today. We're not capable of doing it. We can barely understand most or even some of the elements of what life is like, especially on Earth, which is a complicated and more difficult planet than some others. So this being the case, the God who seeks to express itself through this world is a being who wants to eventually develop life that is co-creative with it and can develop more of God itself as it develops itself. So God is not like a static being. It's dynamic. It's a wonderful experience for it and for us. And it says to itself, well, here I'm going to create this world. out of fire, basically, because in the beginning you want to sterilize it. So you make it just so there's nothing left of what used to be life out of prior worlds and solar systems. That's our, everything comes from those earlier existences. You want to sterilize it because you don't want anything left over. In DNA terms, you would say, well, you don't want any DNA running around from some billions of years earlier life from another planet, because that would kind of spoil things. You wanted to have a life to have a real, we'll say, beginning that is without any preconceived issues going on. As far as the type of DNA, type of structure of form that's going to be used. But there's a problem, because we live in the basement. We're in the lowest dimension right now. And the beginning of life cannot start in the basement. That's the weird thing about it. Life has to start as a, at a minimum, as a reflection of great, great beings in the realm called the Atmic realm. Some people call it the dimension of Nirvana. There's all kinds of other names for it. But this realm is just a realm where spirit and energy are divided up. And spirit, again, is the thought of God. And how God's thought is going to be expressed within energy is decided upon millions of years before any life at all appears on a planet. So this is what's taking place. If we go back, oh, say 4.5 to 6 billion years ago, on Earth. Earth is still a single planet and may not have even crashed with another planet and become two merged planets, if you've seen the recent theories about that. And the moon hasn't been formed yet. I mean, it's basically, as they say, the scientists today say, it was a lifeless world. And I certainly can buy that. Poisonous atmosphere to any kind of form of life. And then when the two planets combine, if you're familiar with that theory, the fire that's resulted from that wipes anything possible that could be alive on the planet out, because the surface of the planet becomes as hot as the surface of the sun. And that's pretty hot, like 10,000 or more degrees Fahrenheit. That's up there. And so everything gets sterilized, cool, and the moon pops up out of all this mess, comes out of the crust of the Earth itself, or the old Earth. And the new moon is kind of also molten and everything else. And so, and it's right very close to the Earth, creating terrible tidals and in the molten parts of the Earth. Strange things are going on, but those are good things, because that's how you want to start. You want to start with everything being a clean slate. But here is the issue. Life doesn't start with enough consciousness in the physical realm to be able to sustain itself. So it can't be alive just because you put some chemicals together, maybe 100 million years after the great event of creating what we call the real planet Earth. You can't do it because the chemicals themselves don't, there's no way to develop the level of consciousness that's necessary to produce the kind of chemistry necessary for the most primitive forms of life, which we'll call like bacteria, very beginning bacteria of some certain sorts. And bacteria are not even completely, they're not even completely necessarily fully developed in some ways. The earliest bacteria weren't. They have a lot of, we'll say, missing parts. Okay, but these bacteria are going to do something very critical. We'll get to that. And so here's a system that is has to have, it's like the chicken and egg problem. How are you going to get life to think well enough to be able to take in certain kinds of chemicals, give off certain kinds, but also, in the case of these bacteria, work as a unit or a colony together? They actually relate to each other in some odd ways. and they build these like big mushroom looking things, a couple feet tall, a foot or two wide. And how is that going to happen in shallow seas around the globe? Because that's one of the first parts of life. Well, the way it works is that the lowest part of the dimensionality, that something that is conscious and comes from God can create on, is called the higher monastic realm, or the higher mental world. Because that's where concepts come from the higher spiritual, super spiritual thought from the Atman realm. It's sort of a correspondence. It's two layers, two dimensions lower. And it spins in the same direction so it could understand some of those higher ideas coming from the Atman realm. But the higher ideas are too big for it to completely understand. And what's created in these lower realms is an actual being, a being called a soul. Now, these souls aren't like our souls. They aren't individual souls. They're souls for zillions and zillions of life forms of a specific genus of bacteria. And originally, there was probably only one soul that started off with one specific type of bacteria. And then some of those split off and became more specialized and got different souls coming in. And these souls think. They think not quite as well as a human being does, but their thought isn't too bad. And they mostly think along the ideas that are coming from higher realms. And they're helped by an even higher being that is not at all ever in physical form or has anything to do directly with something in physical form. And it's called a monad. It's like a being who has tremendous understanding, tremendous consciousness, even greater consciousness than he has any sense, less sense than consciousness. That's really unusual. And it gives up a good deal of its freedom. So it actually has more consciousness than it even has creativity. So it's not highly creative. I don't want you to think that it is. But it has this vast wealth of consciousness, which it lends to spirit, and spirit then becomes the thought from the Atman plane below the monadic dimension and below. So the monads stay way up there in what is the second dimension of our universe, and in the third dimension, or nirvanic or Atmic dimension, you start having ideas, great ideas, involving spirit and spiritual thinking. And then you go two more dimensions down to the fifth, and the monadic dimension, the monastic dimension, in the higher part of it, you start developing group souls. And what does the group soul do? What is its intention? Its intention is to be the thinking part, especially the thinking part that emphasizes understanding, for all of the life forms that are created below that of any human form. So all life forms before human forms are created by these group souls. And the very first ones give some level of consciousness, a very small amount, that is lent to, we'll say, borrowed from this group soul to a whole vast number, trillions possibly, of bacteria that work together because the group soul is telling them to, and they are staying along, even. They are seeking to live because the group soul is telling them to. Did you ever wonder in the theories of evolution how come it's just supposed or adopted as some kind of ipso facto, that means it is automatically true, that life wants to sustain itself? How come? How come bacteria want to continue to be bacteria and they want to grow more bacteria? Did you ever think about that? Where in the evolutionary model does that come from? No place. There's no part of the evolutionary model that deals with consciousness. Consciousness is what gives life the desire to continue to exist. Why? Because consciousness tells life, like it told God, what it is in relationship to what it is not, and how it can choose to or not become connected to other parts of life, which makes its existence even more meaningful and interesting. Even bacteria find life interesting enough so they want to stick around. They have the, we'll say, motive to want to exist. But that motive does not come from a bunch of chemicals. It comes from God, which is stepped down by monads and eventually by group souls. Isn't that interesting? I'm sure a lot of you haven't thought of that before. But that's the tenacious element of why life is. Interestingly, the name of the show, right? The tenacious element of why life is because God is, and life is a part of God. And all are self-created. So the only reason bacteria remain as bacteria and continue to operate together, and they did so about 4 billion years ago, give or take, is because they have a soul. Now, granted, they're not very conscious, but they're conscious enough to understand that they want to live, and they want to also interact and to live together. So the very first life was amazingly collective right from the get-go, and there's no way evolutionary-wise, using a mechanical model, you can explain that. And it's why we can't and haven't been able to turn our computers into that sort of thing. Because for a computer to do that, want to live, want to interact, not be programmed to, needs to have a soul. Could a computer someday have a soul? I don't think we'd call it a computer anymore. But the answer is all things are possible if that which we're talking about has the desire that God had to understand itself and other things. So if we build a computer and we give it soul-like abilities that connect it to a real soul somewhere, it might be able to do that. It might want to understand itself and others. But we're far from that, believe me. Don't kid yourself about all the games and other silly things that are around that seem like, oh, well, it's really alive. It's not alive because it doesn't exist without the programs. The programs are mimics of what we call our, we'll say, understandings and our reflections of our desires. But they aren't self-created. So a computer would have to create its own programs, its own meaningful existence. It's a big deal. Are human beings ever capable of doing that? Well, maybe. Sometime in the distant future, I think, yes. It's more likely we'll develop something that is destructive at the present time. Not because it's conscious, but because it lacks consciousness. And that could be a dangerous issue. That's probably for another show. But for right now, I'll just leave you thinking about that. Okay, so here we are. We're starting off 4.1 billion, 4 billion, something like that, years ago, and we have these proto-bacteria that eventually become colonies of bacteria, and other life forms that start developing. But the very first thing is that these bacteria take a planet devoid of almost all oxygen, and they actually produce oxygen. They take the water, and they live in a water environment, and they're actually able to produce some elements of oxygen in the process that they're using to develop what we call hydrocarbons. Now, it's important to realize that this is all planned, that this isn't happening because a bunch of chemicals with some lightning suddenly made some kind of stew that is now thinking. It doesn't work. Even those experiments in the 1950s where they made amino acids that could maybe someday support some kind of life, none of that quote-unquote life-like stuff they ever made showed any signs of even the most basic bacteria. Couldn't grow itself. It didn't sustain itself by having any understanding of its environment, connecting with anything in its environment in some meaningful way that helped to grow itself more. None of that happened in those experiments or any experiments since. So don't be fooled by what you may read in textbooks, because they leave all that part out. Okay? So, we start off with life being at a very, very low level of consciousness, but still conscious to some level. It also means that the life that's physically on Earth has a soul that is giving some kind of preconceived thought about doing the most basic things, but that thought is coming from two higher dimensions beyond where it exists. So very meager amounts of what we call preconceived thought can really get through to the life forms. It has to be very basic, because anything super complex, the dimensional problems in conveying thought are very large, and it makes it quite difficult for life to be able to carry out most of the conscious parts of a soul. Only very basics. So this beginning life is really just trying to do a couple of things. One is to develop a body that has some sense of something around it. What are the senses in the bacteria? Well, they can sense some chemicals that are important in its, we'll say, relationship with its environment. They can sense oxygen and sulfur and some types of iron, and they can sense an atmosphere filled with what we would consider to be toxic elements for our kind of life. But they take in that and give out oxygen. And over time, the planet becomes more, we'll say, hospitable for life forms that can have more levels of sense than the bacteria are capable of creating themselves. And from the bacteria, other forms of life develop, but not just in a singular fashion as presently is understood in evolution. Evolution is too linear. But a lot of people are starting to realize that, starting to change their ideas about it. So what is happening when the bacteria are producing? We also have very, very, very primitive forms, we'll call them plants, that really are algae of sorts. And these plants start using some of the oxygen. And the reason they prefer oxygen is oxygen allows them to grow faster and to be more mobile in some respects, and to develop a greater sense, which then allows them to have a greater level of consciousness. So it's kind of interesting that we move from a almost sub-life to something that we could identify even today as being life, such as algae. And there really were as many or more kinds of algae on Earth, say 3.5 to 4 billion years ago, than there are today. So a lot of different complex forms of algae started to develop. And eventually, in addition to the algae, if you go back to about 1 billion years ago, we had some life forms being developed that and they, some of them did not necessarily come from algae or bacteria. Because remember, life can be developed from any source of what we call, at least on our planet, hydrocarbons and eventually proteins. So it, you can really develop a lot of different forms of life, provided you have souls. You see, the souls are the big issue that I'm presently missing. As soon as you have a soul, life comes together way faster than an evolutionary model would propose, about 5 to 10 times based upon mathematical models. So present science suggests that life has developed far too quickly on Earth for the evolutionary time scale necessary if we were using the older models in evolution. But that's because they're souls, and they make up for the consciousness. They, by giving consciousness to life, they allow for a much faster development of any kind of life. As a matter of fact, I'm saying that in most circumstances, life would never develop, period, if you didn't have souls, because it would take so long that planets, they change so quickly in relative terms from the time it takes to create life on it, they would never be able to catch up in adaptation to the changes. So life would never get a chance. That's my opinion. Okay, moving on. Eventually, we end up with life that develops more than just a sense of chemistry, but it also develops a sense, a direct sense of other life and a cooperative interaction, sometimes a hostile and interactive mechanism that's based upon eventually what we say evolution is about, which is survival of the fittest and the strongest of any particular expression of a genotype becoming dominant. But that's really not true. Again, this whole scenario of some life forms supporting each other, other life in symbiotic relationships, sometimes in a more connected than just a symbiotic relationship, and other life forms eating each other and being combative, you know, survival of the fittest. Those things are methods that are part of evolution, but they're just, they're nothing more than mechanical methods that are used by souls to help the forms of the life forms that are being brought into existence in the physical world to, on their own, eventually develop some level of self-consciousness that is then built on an attitude by the soul. So really, this whole process is something that is designed. And again, if you don't have any souls, it would take way longer than the Earth has been in existence to get where we are. I mean, we're literally leapfrogging in some circumstances way ahead than the time would allow for some of the very fast developments, because about, give or take, about 570 to 600 million years ago, life suddenly took a Cambrian period. Suddenly a big jump in sense, a huge jump, and in diversification, and in interaction, and in all kinds of models. And it was doing so also because there was more oxygen, but much more so because there was a sudden step up in consciousness. And you can't explain it in any other way because of the way that life expressed itself. You can always see consciousness if you're looking for it, because, again, it's the ability for the animal or form or plant to be able to intelligently interact with its environment and to do so in ways that shows that it is responsive. And this is a big deal. This is a huge deal. Because consciousness means that there is a meaning to nature of the life existence. If there were no meaning, then one animal going to eat another, the other animal wouldn't try and escape because its life would be meaningless and it wouldn't care. But it does. And why is that? Because it has self-consciousness. Now, we don't find that kind of self-consciousness until about a billion years ago. Before that, it didn't even exist. That's a real special kind of self-consciousness, where one animal is trying to feed on another animal, or one animal is feeding on a plant, and the plant starts developing defenses to the animal's feeding on it, and all this other stuff, until you reach a point where it makes a difference. It makes a difference. And again, how do you explain that? Well, you have to explain consciousness. Well, we're going to take a break right now. I'll let you think about what I just said. Mull it over. Think about it. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we're talking about the development of consciousness, and I left you all with that pressing question. If something doesn't have the qualities that I define as consciousness, then based upon the model of mechanical engineering of chemicals and eventually genes, etc., why does anything want to, desire to be alive? Why does anything seek to express itself? Why does it seek to dominate some other kind of life or escape the dominance of some other kind of life? Why are any of those things in existence in an evolutionary model? Okay. I mean, an evolutionary model, that is all there is. Because I believe in evolution. I think it's a great tool. But it isn't anywhere near the whole picture. Okay, so let's let's move on to the development of consciousness. Consciousness is a way for life to grow itself, to understand itself and others, to eventually, as it develops itself, eventually it has to make a big change. And that is to move from a place where it's only understanding itself in relationship to other things around itself, including other kinds of life, to understanding that there are souls, and to understanding that there is a God, and there is spirit in non-spiritual thinking, and all the things that basically makes human beings. Human beings are a huge jump in consciousness from the next kinds of life forms that are called animals. Human beings are not animals. Animals are animated. They have a response pattern that shows that their level of consciousness is to be highly responsive in an active way with other life around them, more so than our vegetables or plants. And so they have this wonderful improvement, we'll say, in consciousness over lower forms of life than animals. And the highest forms of animals are the most responsive to life in general, but they are not responsive to spirit, which is the thought of God, nor are they responsive to understanding or being conscious of God. And in fact, they have virtually zero of that. And so that's what makes humans a part of an image or a more direct expression of their own creator. Because humans have all of the consciousness necessary to be able to understand that there is a creator and to understand much, much more than just being able to respond to life or even to love life or like life, because animals can do that. But animals can't love or like God because they don't understand, nor are they conscious of it. So humans are a unique improvement in consciousness. The development of consciousness between animals and people requires that there be a change from group souls that mostly create preconceived thought we call instincts. Ever think about that? What's an instinct and where does that come from? Does it come from a bunch of chemicals that are patterned in a certain way, in a double helix, or does it come from spirit? But certainly the jump is necessary because preconceived thought is always dealing with the past part of time. So the best that a soul can do, because it's two dimensions away from physical things, or one dimension from the astral world, because some life later on exists in the astral world, but it doesn't matter, it's still dimensionally pretty far away from group souls. And group souls just can't think fast enough, nor do they have a unique connection with any specific life form. They just average. And they preconceive their thought in averages, which we sometimes refer to as instincts, and give this to a group of life forms that they are associated to. It works for animals because they don't have to have as much understanding of their surroundings to be able to function at the level of life that they are at. So for animals, this is sufficient in most cases. But for human beings, it's extremely insufficient, and if we had group souls, we would never get out of the animal kingdom. Instead, we have one soul, an individual soul, that is connected to us through a whole bunch of lifetimes that we call incarnations with a personality. that is subconscious to ourself. So it, the personality doesn't have much consciousness. It has some, a small level, that is strangely preconceived. So the personality is more like an animal than it is human. It's sort of like the animal part of us. And it's subconscious to ourself, so we can't immediately recognize that it even exists. But it does a lot, especially until we are adults. It's runs a large part of our life. And that means that the individual soul has limited contact with our personalities because the personality is more like an animal and it mostly functions with preconceived thought than it does with complex thought that is individually tailored to the interactions of a human and their interactions leading to more understanding. As we seek understanding, we move away from our personality and become more self-driven. What does that mean? The conscious part of us is ourself. It's subservient to the personality unless it understands enough of itself and the personality, both, and they have to be nearly equal. And once that understanding of self is established, it can supersede its personality. But it cannot supersede its personality if it doesn't first develop a level of understanding of itself and of its personality, including the parts of its personality which are subconscious. So those parts have to become conscious. And then the self becomes actualized to the level that it now seeks more relationship with its soul than it does with its personality. Interestingly, humans can go through hundreds of lifetimes before, on a consistent level, a human being chooses to live that way. And once a human being experiences that, if it chooses to go backwards, it suffers immensely. Not because it's being punished by a bad God, but because the loss of consciousness that results over time, even though it might be having a great time, it thinks, while it is following its personal interests, if it goes backwards in time. But the loss of consciousness, which is really happening, even though it doesn't recognize it, because when we lose consciousness, we become less understanding of the fact we're losing it faster than we lose it, so it becomes very difficult to realize it's happening, is what is the real definition of suffering? Human beings become more and more, we'll say, caught in a meaningless existence. Well, they may go out and do a lot of things and think that they're having a good time doing them. But the meaninglessness of their existence eats away, literally, between their self and their soul. And they become more and more desperate and, we'll say, depressed, a sense of loss. This is the interesting part about the process, is that most people don't know when they're in it, and they don't even recognize if they're rebelling against it, moving away from it, but there are built-in mechanisms to help us, and one of those mechanisms is to suffer. Terrible kind of thing, you might say, but unfortunately, it's the only way, as far as I understand it, that God could come up with to allow humans to be free. If any other method is employed, again, as I've been taught by some others beyond me, if human beings are given, we'll say, some kind of barometer or some instant knowledge or understanding that can turn into understanding of this loss beforehand, it boomerangs. And what it turns into is the human turns into a robot. And they stop literally being self-created. Oddly, I'm going to give you a little sideline note. This experiments were done with this very concept a number of times. The last time was at the turn of the 19th century. Some beings from beyond the human kingdom wanted to see if there was some way, by having more direct contact with human beings, maybe they could break through and have more direct contact with their soul by imitating and relying on the suggestions of these great beings and trying to be helpful. Now, this experiment had already been done thousands of times in different locations of the world for hundreds of thousands of years, really, and going back in time to what people call the Atlantean, prehistoric times. Oh, we've got somebody calling in right now. Let's find out who that is. Hello, caller. Hi.
Hi, Niles. It's Matthew again. How are you?
Good, Matthew. How are you doing?
Doing good. I just wanted to ask you a question. You were just talking about group souls, and that brought to mind the whole idea of apes. And I hear scientists talking about how chimpanzees differ in DNA from like only 3% from humans, and you know, they're teaching some apes sign language. I just wanted to know where apes stand with group souls and individual souls.
Yeah, well, apes are further away than are probably your pet dog or cat. The reason being that they usually don't have much contact with people. They're pretty difficult to have as companions. So the reason they don't have near the consciousness of a dog or cat, yet they can have the intelligence beyond a dog or cat, because intelligence means the ability to take information from their senses, which their senses are great, and use that information to derive knowledge about their world. They are better at deriving knowledge than dogs or cats, but not as good with consciousness. They can't apply that knowledge in new and unique ways create a lot of new understandings. They can be taught things like sign language and even ask questions like, where did I come from? Actually, there's a few that have actually asked that question. But when it's explained to them, they can't understand it. Oddly, a dog or cat might have a little bit better understanding about God, at least in the sense that they have a bonding with some humans, which has a respect for the human being beyond just love. Some animals have shown, that are pets anyway, the ability to comprehend a more meaningful existence by the relationship that they have with their quote-unquote master or owner than they have even with each other. That is a critical factor. Generally speaking, apes are a bit below that, but they still have a slight amount of that if they are really brought up close to humans, although there's limitations because of their nature. Especially chimps. You're better off with an orangutan if you're going to try that process, by the way. They're more conscious than chimps. But in any case, because, again, they don't have the nature that humans have, they don't have a heart chakra or a crown chakra that specifically is conscious. Therefore, their consciousness of God, those are the two senses we have that give us understanding of God, are not functional. They don't live their life based upon principles and ethics and seeking to grow more into becoming greater themselves so that they can express the godliness they see and experience in the world around themselves. They don't do that. They can be taught things, but they aren't seeking that kind of expression. They may enjoy learning some things, but they don't apply the learning to self-creation. Therefore, it doesn't mean anything. So the fact that they know sign language or the fact that they can count how many bananas they have doesn't mean something in terms of self. And that's really the bottom line about consciousness.
Okay.
So I hope that has explained it for you.
It does. It's very interesting because that's not obviously not what science is saying. If you look at an ape, they look so much like us. And even if you look at some of the fossils they have of pre-humans, and they're connected, they say how they're connected to apes. I think it's interesting that you're saying that they're even further from us than dogs and cats.
They are if the dogs and cats are living with us and our pets. Now, dogs and cats running wild, that, you know, you take a cat that is running around the neighborhood and is basically not a pet of anybody. That kind of animal is not the animal I'm talking about. I'm talking about a cat that has a close relationship. There are other kinds of animals that can be brought into that sphere. And in addition, if we talk about primitive life or primitive forms of what they call apes, some of those were degenerated human beings. So it's very confused right now. And there's a ape that from West Africa that they found. They think it's an ape from 6 to 7 million years ago that is obviously more conscious based upon its lifestyle than the apes from 3.5 million years ago, like Australopithecus, because
right.
This particular ape was really a degenerated form of a race of Lemurians. So and that's why it was found in West Africa instead of East Africa. I mean, there's all kinds of odd things that, you know, that don't fit. The evolutionary model just doesn't add up. When you put it all together, things aren't becoming more and more conscious. They aren't becoming more and more, we'll call, socially active together. They're becoming less from 7 million years to 3.5. And so there's a strange, we'll say, odd, non-evolutionary issue. And part of that has to do with de-evolution, which is not yet accepted in evolutionary circles. So. But de-evolution has been talked about by a number of evolutionary writers in the last 20 years. So it isn't like it isn't completely known, it's just not accepted. Okay, so
okay.
Hopefully that gives you some further ideas to think about.
Yeah, it does. I look forward to seeing what new discoveries they make and how they fit that on their evolutionary tracks.
Well, maybe they should start reading some of the pages of the textbook I wrote. Might help them out. Okay, thanks for calling in.
All right,
bye. So we were getting to some examples of the development of consciousness in humans and how really when we think about it, when we look at the process, we can see that human beings are seeking to develop themselves, unlike apes. I mean, you can teach apes all kinds of amazing things, but, you know, at the end of the day, they still aren't trying to express themselves as humans do. They don't want to have a more meaningful life than the life they have because they don't have a perspective of their creator within themselves. And until they do, which means they would have individual souls and they would have human beings, they're not going to. So that's the real bottom line here. I hope that this is making sense to all of you out there because it's hard to understand consciousness since you have to have a certain level of it to really grasp its full meaning. Okay, so let's move further. In human beings, when we see an individual soul interacting with a human being, what's really taking place is the human being, as it sees more of God within itself through these two senses I just described, the heart and crown chakra. Animals can have heart and crown chakras, but they have no consciousness within them. So without consciousness there, they can sense something, but they can't understand it. They can sense God, but they can't understand it. Having a sense of God gives an animal the capability of love and affection and many virtues, but unfortunately, it doesn't give it a sense of self in identifying itself with its creator. And therefore, that's the key. So we as human beings seek to create ourselves into our creator, be co-creative, as I call it. And in doing so, it automatically puts us into a hugely different species. It isn't just a matter of intelligence. I know a lot of people say, well, we have bigger brains. Our brains are 1,500 cc's and the apes are 400. So but the fact is that Neanderthals, as an example, have bigger brains than we have today by about 100, 150 cc's or so. Sometimes larger, depending upon which Neanderthal. The other weird thing about it is that Neanderthals with the biggest brains were the ones from the earliest times that we can find Neanderthals, which is about maybe 300,000 BC or so. Now, a lot of evolutionists want to believe that Neanderthals came from earlier species of, we'll say, hominids, and pre Homo sapiens. Some of them think that they came from this specific, like Peking man, et cetera. But they can't really connect them because they don't connect. There's genetic differences, and they are starting to find these genetic differences. So there's real problems there. Where did they come from? Well, I wrote that they came from a race of Atlanteans. They called the sixth subrace. And they came from about 400,000 years ago when that race was pretty much not doing so well. And it started to disintegrate over the next 100, 150,000 years. They came from that. And these were degenerating peoples. These were de-evolving peoples. And they had bigger brains. They had initially high intelligence, but the intelligence was mostly astral and not mental because they came from a different race of people. That race of people was developing itself astrally, not so much mentally. And so their whole lifestyle revolved around a more astral existence than monastic, even though they had a large brain. Now, what did they use their brain for? Well, if they were obviously, in my mind, more focused on the consciousness dealing with astral or feelings, most of their brain dealt with recording and understanding of theirs and others' feelings than they were about more complex or conceptual thoughts. And brains are just storage devices, so they stored a lot better how they felt over a period of time than we do. We actually have given up a large portion of our brain, the midbrain, some of it is called, hypothalamus, etc., that records feelings. And most of our higher brain functions don't record feelings very well. Let me give you an example. Think about, in your own life, 5 years ago, how did you feel on a specific week or month or even day, 5 years ago? Do you know? Do you know how you felt last month, really, on a specific day? You notice how we don't record feelings very well. We do have a part of our brain that does so within a few hours of time, called the midbrain, the hypothalamus, the reticular activating system, but not in the cerebral cortex. We gave that up as a race, unlike the Neanderthals, to improve our ability to remember concepts and thought forms, examples of those concepts, over time in our past, and we used the brain for that purpose, but we gave up a lot of memory of feelings. That may surprise you, but if you do some research into your own nature, I think you'll find that what I'm saying is confirmed. And you will realize that, wow, we really are different. And let me tell you something else. Animals are much, much better at remembering their feelings from a year ago than we are. So a dog or cat that is traumatized will remember that trauma in relationship to whatever it experiences in its environment for a much longer period of time than a human being will. Now, you could say, well, gee, that sounds like they're better off than we are. Well, yeah. In some respects, they might be if we're not willing to think about things and understand things conceptually. We're supposed to take the feelings and convert them into a concept. The concept then can be reconverted back to the feeling at some later time, but we don't have to remember the feeling anymore. And remember, the feeling takes up more space, and you're going to have a bigger brain in relationship to do that, so consequently you have Neanderthals with bigger brains. By that, brains that think in a mental sense more, but that remember in an astral sense. Our brains really don't do our thinking for us. They really are a resource for drawing of facts, of information that have been turned into knowledge. So they're like a storage of knowledge. But they don't do the real thinking. The real thinking is done in the mental mind and is conceptual, at least in part, for a lot of people. So that's the difference. We really don't even understand our very nature, and we don't understand the nature of other creatures and beings around us. We don't understand that evolution can de-evolve, and therefore so can consciousness. The Neanderthals, if they were, as I believe them to be, the sixth subrace, most of them, of this Atlantean race that degenerated into this creature that lived in caves, basically. They lost consciousness, even though they retained a fairly large physical brain. They still could remember a lot more feelings than we can, but they had the consciousness lower than that of their predecessors, because when a creature or a human de-evolves, it loses its ability to understand. And eventually it will lose its ability to store knowledge as well, but that's a different issue. And eventually it will lose its ability to make and construct complex concepts in today's world. But for the earlier times, that wasn't real well developed in humans anyway. We don't recognize that human beings are different today than they were thousands and thousands of years ago, even hundreds of years ago in some sense. So we are changing all the time. We're becoming more conceptual. But in the process, we may be giving up some abilities we used to have. I find that intriguing. Okay, so let me sum up. I'm going to take a little break here, give people a little cooling off time. Let me sum up where we're at right now. Consciousness is different than knowledge. Consciousness is the ability to take knowledge and apply it to new things. And we do it because we want to understand who we are in relationship to everything else. And especially for human beings, consciousness includes who we are in relationship to our Creator. Not true for animals. Animals have some level of self-consciousness if they are the more advanced ones, such as we talked about chimpanzees, and especially dogs and cats that are our companions. But that level of self-consciousness is still much lower than the level in which any creature could possibly function in that doesn't have an individual soul. Individual soul gives us the ability for us to have a unique relationship with that soul, and that unique relationship with that soul is like a reflection of ourself. So we can see ourself and the more selfish part of us, our personality, in juxtaposed positions, allowing us to make self-created changes to become more like our soul, which is like an extension and a lower level, easier for us to see as our God. So if we want to be closer to God, we need to expose our personalities, understand that the personality is the selfish part of us, not any longer needed, and we can develop ourself into something that's part of our soul, which is called the higher self. So we could become like our soul, which is a part of God, if we choose to, because we are capable of doing so, because we have individual souls and we have two senses that are fully conscious if we use them that way. of God in our soul. That's different than animals. They're just not equipped that way. Even our closest companions, our pets, can't achieve that kind of experience in life. They can understand a little bit about it because they get close enough to us to get kind of by close association, get a little feeling of it by being around us if we act that way. So if we are virtuous, and if we are co-creating with our Creator, our pets will start expressing a little bit of it in some of their behaviors. Isn't that wonderful? It's fantastic. Okay, let me just give you a couple minutes to go, whew, wow, I just need a little room here to think about whatever this guy's talking about. The last month or two, I've been getting like a massage a month just to kind of work the kinks out and to get my physical body less tense, because we're always dealing with things. This is a spiritual group that are sometimes very tough. We deal with evil. Now, I'm not going to tell you how and exactly what, but evil sometimes is directly in our face. And in dealing with evil, we have to do some amazingly difficult things. And it takes a toll on us. And it makes me tense at times. And there's other things that can make any of us tense in life. You don't have to just be dealing with evil to have tension. I've been seeing a licensed massage therapist. Her name is Amy Better. And I think she's a pretty good therapist. Now, if you live in the Phoenix area, particularly on the east side of town, of course, you will know what I'm talking about if you live in Phoenix. Otherwise, you won't understand what I'm saying. But if you live in that general area, the Tempe, Scottsdale, Mesa kind of area, you could see this same massage therapist that I'm seeing. I'm recommending her. And I'm doing this because I really believe she's been helping. So if you would want to make an appointment with her, you can. And I'm going to give out her phone number. You can just call Amy, and that's her name. And just mention, well, I heard about it on Crazy Guy show the other day, whatever you want to say. And her number is 480-292-0847. And one of the things that I like about what she does is she's pretty well attuned to where things are not right. And she is able to use a lot of different, I find her multi-skilled, a lot of different kinds of massage therapy that gets at more areas than a lot of other therapists that I have had experience with in the past. That's the good thing. And she's reasonable in terms of her fees, which is also good. And even though she's not a real big person or anything like that, she has the will and strength to do what she needs to do without hurting you or using over excessive amounts of force, but rather to use skill and a lot of empathy in through touch to understand where things are not quite going right. And she gets the energy moving in the right direction. I'm quite satisfied that she's doing me some world of good in helping. And I would suggest strongly you give her a call. And she has an office that she works out of. I don't know. You can make arrangements with her how you're going to work it out. But worthwhile. Amy Better, just like Better, a licensed massage therapist. Also, I want to mention, if you haven't already heard, I suggested you consider, if you're in trouble, you need to refinance, or if you just want to go for green, if that's what you think is good for you. You can get green loans for energy efficiency from Kavita over at Nova Home Loans. Now, she covers Arizona, but she may be able to refer you to somebody in the state or area that you're in. So you can call her. And she can be reached at 480-430-6911. That's 480-430-6911. Give Kavita a call. and see if she can help you out. One of the things about green loans that's so nice is that the loan to value on the home, based upon current laws, gives you a more advantageous loan. And people who are presently underwater, some, can take advantage of some of these green loan programs and actually get a loan where they couldn't under normal circumstances. So wrapped into the loan, they agree that they're going to do certain things to increase the efficiency of their house, and the loan, the value may drop 10 points, 10%, putting them, actually I think it's like 12 to 15, whatever it is, putting them within range of being able to refinance where normally they can't. And that's a big deal for some people because they aren't right now aren't able to afford their payments. And instead of losing their home, they get a more efficient home with lower payments. So it's a cool thing, yeah. Okay, and I just also want to mention that we're still working on it. It's still coming. Yeah, Fai-Chi Jizik is on its way. I put it within about a couple weeks out because we still have to get all the ingredients delivered. They're coming beginning of next week. And then there's a process, of course. But it's really almost here. Chris, I've been using some of the R&D stuff, and I can tell you it really works. It's extremely helpful for reducing whatever kinds of pains most people have. And it is, it's herbs. It's what it is. It's herbs. There's a lot of them. And a couple, two nutraceuticals and herbs. It's all that's in there. And it really does a really good job. Now, I know a lot of you say, well, you've been telling us for 2 months. When are we going to see? Well, yeah, unfortunately, it just takes a long time these days. These are specially made. They aren't just buying like you would normally place an order. We're having them specially made. So and it takes a bunch of time to get them together and actually have them eventually in one place. So we're almost there, okay? So hopefully you will wait for it because it's coming. And if you still can, still are interested to get some ideal cell sorption resveratrol, we do have some of that available, and you can still get that. You can call foreveryoungproducts.com, 800-777-7850, and someone can talk to you about that. Okay, I've gotten done with all those announcements, et cetera. Hopefully, we'll come back now to consciousness. One of my more favorite subjects to talk about. Okay, so consciousness in human beings is considerably different than consciousness in any life form less than humans because we have individual souls, because we have consciousness in the maximum number of centers you can have consciousness in, which is major centers anyway, that in this case equals a total of 7. And animals don't have consciousness in 7 centers. They have a maximum consciousness in only 5 centers maximum. And then we have also not consciousness, but we have sense in about 370, give or take a couple, of minor centers. That's like the acupuncture places in your body. And those centers give us a greater realm of information that is accumulated in our senses than most other life forms. Some life forms have more in certain places, but the accumulative total is greater in human beings than actually any life form, below, up to and below us. So this is critical because more information helps us to gain better knowledge, and then we can take the knowledge and use our consciousness to apply it in so many different ways to build ourself and to make us who we are. We are self-created like God. Now, what does that really mean? That means that 2 people, 100 people, can live identical information lives. That means that their experiences could be identical for the first 20, 30, 40, whatever years you want to make. And each one would be uniquely different because they choose in consciousness on how they're going to use that information, convert it into knowledge, and apply it to an understanding of who they are in relationship to others, and most importantly, as a co-creator with God. Now, what if someone doesn't believe in God and say, well, I can't have that, right? Actually, not so. Some people don't believe, quote-unquote, in God, but they believe in what God's thought is, spiritual, and they follow spiritual thinking, even though they say, I don't believe there's a God. Doesn't matter then. God doesn't care. As long as you're following in the footsteps, so to speak, of spiritual thinking. Remember, you're not going to replicate God's thought, you're going to co-create. As long as you're being virtuous in your creations, you're living part of your co-creator, even if you don't recognize it. And so you're still experiencing a growth in consciousness, and you're still okay. Yes, atheists can be completely conscious and develop their consciousness just as much as people who are not atheists. It isn't a requirement. It really has to do with how much virtue you're creating in the world. If you're creating a lot of virtue, then you're still on the right track. Now we have somebody online right now. Hello, caller.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question for you.
Okay, what's your question?
I occasionally attempt to read these theosophical texts, and they talk about consciousness in the mineral kingdom as well as the plant, animal, and human realms. And
yes,
that sort of blows my mind. I have trouble getting my mind around that, what it means to have consciousness in terms of minerals, and just wondered if you have any input on that topic.
Well, yeah. Did you hear the beginning of tonight's show? Because I actually was talking something that related to that. You may have come in. Did you hear it or not at the beginning of the show?
I may have missed the very beginning. I remember talking about bacteria, but it's...
Okay, well, that was kind of the beginning. Let's think of it this way. Chemicals, which are part of the mineral kingdom, and even rocks, et cetera, are part of the mineral kingdom. But let's go below bacteria, because bacteria still are recognized as a life form, whereas rocks and other things are not. But yet rocks do have a level of consciousness. It's just that their consciousness comes from only one sense in particular. Their sense is a sense of pressure and sometimes of, we'll call it, temperature variance. And these kinds of things are not enough sense to develop life, because I didn't speak of it this way, but life needs, to be fully animated in some fashion, life needs to have at least a couple of senses that aren't developed enough so that they can react from one sense to the other back and forth and do some comparison. And rocks and those types of things don't have that much sense. So I call them pre-life. And there are souls that are connected to pre-life things, like rocks, etc. What they do is they tell those things, which are not yet living, how to, over time, develop into the bacteria that I began the show with, and how they can form the chemistry necessary so that can take place. So they accelerate tremendously the process of developing life on a planet like Earth, because instead of it taking just tens of millions of years for enough of the chemicals of life to be found, it would have taken hundreds or even billions of years on a planet without there being, quote-unquote, a soul in the background doing some thinking for the chemistry involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think the theosophists are really getting at, is that they're trying to say, well, these things actually have a group soul, even though that group soul and the rocks themselves wouldn't be described by my definition as life. They are like a pre-life condition. So I think that it's not that far of a leap to say, well, they're just part of the continuum of life. There's a part that doesn't really have yet all the qualities that life might have. One of the qualities that rocks are missing is the ability to create more of themselves. And life, by definition, has to be able to be self-created and therefore further create more of itself. And I haven't seen any rocks getting together to do that lately. But maybe someday we'll discover some that are, and that would become something pretty neat. But
yeah.
I don't
well,
think...
And they point to radioactivity as something. You know, it's a dynamic activity amongst rocks.
Well, actually, the interesting thing about that is radioactivity. I wrote this textbook that I explained radioactivity about. And radioactivity is one of the higher forms of being a rock. If you're going to be a cool rock, it would be kind of neat to give off some radioactive energy. But the fact of the matter is that radioactivity's biggest role is inside the Earth, not even on the surface. And inside the Earth, it keeps the heat high enough in the core of the Earth so that it stays liquid, because if it doesn't stay liquid, we won't have a magnetosphere, and without a magnetosphere, we would lose life on our planet. So it's really important to have enough radioactivity in the core of the Earth so that things stay hot for a lot longer than they normally would. So they do supply an important thing, and that's a really high level of rock, you might say. But, of course, when we take that radioactivity and bring it out here, if we make bombs out of it, it's not so cool. If we use it to maybe do other things which are good, then that may be an okay thing. Okay, so...
Well, thanks. That's a helpful paradigm. I appreciate it.
Sure. You're welcome. Thanks for calling in.
All right.
So let me move on now to how does consciousness then further develop itself in a human being if it's just between the soul, which is a representative of God, and the human being? When does this process really get going and accelerate so the human beings can move ahead and go beyond just being human? Because that's all life is in a state of continual furthering of his consciousness, if my theories and explanations tonight are correct. Well, and then again, it's being self-created, which evolution cannot explain. So where does the process really come from for a human being to move ahead and get their consciousness, say, to the point where they are more conscious than not, where their personality is not controlling them than not, and where the sense of self is in a fairly consistent, if not largely consistent, but fairly consistent state of growing itself into its higher self, which is part of its soul. How is it going to achieve this particular result? Well, one way of looking at it is this, that the human being, since it's self-created, because it's part of life, right, when it reaches the point where the creation of, or I should say co-creation of, God is more important than the creation of its lower self, it then has made the change. I call this change, and you could call it whatever you like, by the way, I call this change the active state of spiritually disciplining yourself. But it has nothing to do with what a lot of people think of as the word discipline. In other words, nobody's telling you what to do. Nobody's forcing you to do anything. But you choose to do it because the co-creation of God becomes far more important than the creation of your lower self. Now, what are things like creation of your lower self? Well, creation of your lower self could be improving any skill you might have. It can be seeking pleasure. It can be seeking happiness. It can be seeking warm, fuzzy feelings from others. It can be seeking sexual gratification. It can be seeking anything that involves the person and using their senses in ways that develops their lower self. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't co-create with God, because it doesn't help others to find God more. And so you know when you're co-creating with God because what you're doing is you're helping others more than helping yourself to find God more. Notice I said more than helping yourself. So if you sit around and meditate all day and you go to some full moon chants or services, or I'm just making this stuff up, or you go to church, or you do what a hundred other things. Maybe you even work in a food bank or something. But if those things don't add up to creating and helping others to become creative, more of their higher selves, so they go on ad infinitum to do the same. If you aren't helping others to become souls, you aren't reaching the point that I'm talking about of being co-creative with God enough to be in a self-generating process of becoming more spiritual. This is a really big, big change. And not everybody is successful with it. You might do it for a while and then leave it for a whole lifetime or five. You might do it for a year or two and stop. You might do it for 10 years or stop. You might do it for 6 months on and off for several lifetimes. But the problem of keeping it going is that most people are, we'll say, initially very selfish because they are more run by their personal self, personal and personality, than they are by their higher self. And the self is in between those, and it falls victim to a state of losing consciousness and meaning in life. And you could say, but is it really meaningful to help others to become more spiritual and to start living more as souls, even more than we're trying to help ourselves live as souls, like meditating? And the answer is yes. That's the odd thing and the unique thing about being human. We grow fastest. We move more quickly to developing ourselves as higher selves and moving out of the human kingdom by helping others to do it more than ourselves. That's the key. It's some people call it self-forgetfulness. It's a state of being that is so unique to humans and so special that only rarely does any other creature have it. And when they do, they don't do it because they're developing themselves from the perspective of doing it, but they're usually doing it as a replication of something that a human is doing. So that's where our pets come into play. Sometimes pets can actually do this very thing, but they don't really understand it. Humans can actually understand it while they're doing it. And the more you do understand it while you're doing it, the faster you move in it. So if you really say, well, yeah, as I look back, I've really been living my life sometimes for others, well, that's a cool thing, and I think that's great. I commend you. But if you say, well, for the last year, I have deliberately and have accomplished living my life more for others than not, and I've been doing so that they can do the same, that's a big, big deal. If you can say that about your life, congratulations. Because if you continue to do that, for not a lot of time, really, a few lifetimes, but you will move to amazing levels. And let me tell you what will happen. The first is you'll start unifying the seven centers in each of the three bodies that are human. So let me name those. The seven centers, which include seven senses, are from the head to the toe, from the head to the lower. I'm going to go from that level. The crown chakra, the ajna center, or brow chakra, some people call it that. Throat chakra, yeah. Then below that, the heart chakra, the solar plexus center, or chakra, the sacral center, or chakra, and finally the sexual center. That's from above your head to like virtually below your waist, far below your waist. Okay, so that's those centers in the human being can start unifying and becoming one sense in not just the physical body or the etheric and physical, but also in the astral and the monastic bodies. If those centers start joining together, you're moving from the human kingdom to the superhuman. What does that give you a sense of then? Because those are senses. They're not just centers of energy. They are senses. They contain sense. And a sense is something that has enough consciousness and enough thought that it attracts little bits and pieces of other energy that is equal to or less than itself. So we can only sense those things that are equal to or less than our own ability to sense, and gives us information about things outside of ourselves. And eventually, if you join together the senses in each of the three bodies, one at a time, and eventually join the three bodies together, but let's start with the etheric physical body. If you join the senses of the etheric physical body, you become all, okay, informed, fully informed about everything that involves your co-creation with God. Everything. So nothing, while you're serving, nothing gets past you, so to speak. As most people say, well, I didn't hear that, see that, sense that. You sense everything that deals with your co-service with God as soon as that happens. If you join those centers together, everything. That's an amazing, amazing state if you think about it. That means you don't make any mistakes while you're co-serving. Now, do you co-serve all the time? Not until you are a member of the next kingdom, which we're going to get to. But still, your level of consciousness is incredible during the time that you're co-serving. And the meaning in your life is based upon the level of your consciousness. So life becomes incredibly more meaningful just from the physical. Now I'm going to go to the astral body. The same thing can happen there. And if everything that I said about the physical happens in the astral, because you have the same kinds of centers, that they sense something different, that what they sense is the movement and direction of energy. And those are things we call feelings. And if you unify your astral centers and use them while you're using them in co-service, your feelings about anything and everything that is going on around you, including all the feelings in other people, and your feelings about God and their feelings about God, you become 100% accurate. Wow. Perfect information while you're in co-service. And then finally, let's talk about the mental. There's a higher and lower mental senses, just like there are in the other bodies. The higher senses give us concepts, and lower senses give us examples of those concepts so we can communicate them in words, just the way I am right now. And that allows us, then, while we're in co-service, in helping others to do the same, that gives us complete and total information about whatever we are co-creating in service with God, in concepts and thought forms, completely and wholly, as long as we're giving it to others. And that's called love wisdom. And in that case, you have total truth in your thinking and complete and total ability to use that truth to help others to do the same. Now, if you join all three of these bodies and use them together at one time, you can live in the mental, astral, and physical worlds all at the same time. The same time. You can sense and live in those worlds at the same time. And you can serve in them at the same time while your mind functions in a place called the Buddhic realm or intuitional world. Another dimension of time and space, even beyond the monastic, and at that point, you're no longer a human being. Because your soul, which is found right now in the higher mental world, liberates itself and goes to live in the intuitional dimension of time and space, which gives it unique qualities different than what a human soul does. We know that a human soul makes us individuals and unique individuals in that we're self-created. But the neat thing about becoming a member of the next kingdom, some people call them masters or whatever you want to call them, doesn't really matter, is that you're not just self-created. You now are higher self unified. And in doing so, you become a super creative being, able to do impossible for human beings. Things. You become omniscient in all areas of service, which virtually is your entire life. So you become fully omniscient. That means all-knowing. And in terms of consciousness, your consciousness changes from being self-focused in some respects. Because no matter how much you do co-serve with God, some of the time human beings are self-focused. To never being self-focused, to always being focused on a collection of all the souls that you can perceive that exist with you in the intuitional and beyond higher realms. You live a life that is freed from time and space, and you can live a life in which futures can become existent realities in which experiments in creation become like on godlike levels. You're not yet omnipotent, but meaning all powerful, but you have the beginnings of great ability to use power in extremely good and virtuous ways. And you become a life of total meaning. Total meaning is different than the meaningfulness of a human's life. Because total meaning means that you live out the meaning not just of yourself, but the meaning of all others who live at and above your level of thinking. So now you're living in an amazing realm of meaningfulness. The ability to live at others above your level is restricted to how much you can co-serve with them, but still you get some of that. And the ability to live with those at your level is 100%. So you live the meaning not of one life, but of hundreds, thousands, who knows, of lives. I know it's a little bit hard. I know the things I'm telling you right now in terms of consciousness are mind-boggling. But that's where we're headed. Now, you might say, well, gee, that sounds wonderful. How do I get there? Well, here's the catch. You can't get there. You can't be there unless you're not trying to be. If you want to get there, if your desire is to live a meaningful life because that sounds so cool and be great, wow, amazing stuff, you never get there because you have to be self-forgetful. You have to do it because you want others, all others, to experience this. The reason you can live the meaning of all others at your level is because you want it more for them than you want it for yourself. As a matter of fact, you want it all for them. And then you receive fantastically more than you give when that happens. You free yourself from all sense of selfishness in this amazing process of the development of human into superhuman consciousness. And the method is called spiritual discipline. Now, I know I've only got a couple of minutes left here, and I'm not going to be able to go very deep into this, but spiritual discipline is a process in which we restrict the selfishness we have by converting the energies that we use for the selfishness into service to others. It involves sacrifice in every instance. So you've got to give up personal interests, personal desires, personal things for the desire to help others and do it in co-service. It's easiest to do it in a spiritual group because others are doing it around you. If you try to do it alone, you'll never succeed. And the reason you won't is because it's too hard to do. You always get caught in the paradox of wanting too hard to get what it means to be spiritual. Well, you can't. That's a paradox. You can't do that. When you do it with others, because they are focused out some of the time, and you're focused out some of the time, it helps each person to do it more. And so you need to do it with others. Now, how do you find those people? Well, you can put a statement up on the internet. I'm looking for people who are doing this, and you just start working with them. Remember that you have to do it in a way in which you're helping others to do the same thing. Not just, it isn't a matter of just giving to people. That won't work. If you give to people on a personal level, you're defeating the whole process. You have to give to people on a soul level. You have to help them to become more giving, help them to become more conscious. If what you do does not help others to become more conscious, no matter how good it seems to you, it's not going in the right direction. I know there's a lot of people who are going to be pretty upset about that because their religion, their other things they've been taught tell them something different. I know. This is not a religious view. This is a spiritual view. What I'm teaching you is beyond some religions, maybe. Or maybe it's wrong in comparison to your religion, and you may reject it. That's okay. I'm only giving this out so that you can ponder it and hopefully contemplate the amazing results that can come from the development of consciousness. This is the real ticket. This is the real deal. It's the reason that people, most likely, although they may not know it, are listening to my voice right now. Not just because tonight's show is on it, but because this show is about that all the time. But you may not know that. All the time. Okay. So if we're going to achieve this, these amazing results, you have to make the decision to do so on a conscious level. I suggest studying, too. Learning some of the things that I've talked about, including some using some of these shows, but possibly reading some books. Yeah, you can read the books I wrote. I think they're pretty helpful. But any book that you find that works for you, fine. And understand particularly what consciousness is, because you can't really develop it if you don't have a clear understanding of it. It's not knowledge. You need knowledge to develop consciousness, but it isn't knowledge. And don't get fooled by that. Having a lot of knowledge without consciousness is sometimes very destructive and oftentimes leads to a quite meaningless life. What you really want is to balance the amount of knowledge you have with its full use to serve others, and then it becomes a builder of consciousness, because then you're using consciousness. You're connecting the knowledge that you have and what you gain to serve others, and so that they can do the same and not just receive something as a present or a gift or even making them feel better or more comfortable or healthier or whatever it may be, because ultimately, if you're not helping them in consciousness, it's all for naught. Why is that? Because all of us came to this physical world from being created by our soul in this incarnation for the purpose of developing our consciousness through all the means that we have talked about tonight. That's the reason we're here, folks. No, we're not here to have a great time and then go party. We're here because our soul created us to help co-create God in this most difficult of all dimensions of time and space in which to do so. I hope this has made some sense to you, and we are out of time. Maybe some other time we'll have another show on this where I'll go into some other aspects of consciousness that I had to skip over. They aren't necessarily the most important parts, but they fill in some of the gaps. Well, until next week, this has been Niles McClower for Why Life Is.